Hey, podcast listeners. You're listening to a recording made in Los Gatos on the 18th of May, 2015. And that's different from the date you're about to hear, which is for our broadcast listeners. Thanks for downloading. This is Geek Speak for Saturday, May 23rd, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. I'm Geek translator Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the studio is Ben Jaffe, a teacher, web developer, traveler, and music geek.
Oh, hi there.
Oh, hello, Ben. Also, Lyle Troxell, a maker, photographer, father, and senior user interface engineer at Netflix.
Hello, Bonnie, and hello, Ben.
Plenty to talk about this week, so let's get down to it with distracted driving.
Yes, so we've talked about distracted driving quite a bit, and I think it's about time that we start talking about wearables and bringing those into the picture.
Right, laws account for cell phone use.
Yeah, a lot of people call it the hands-free driving. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't be holding a phone and whatever. Of course.
How about your wrist?
Also, what if you're holding a burrito? I mean, like, so if you... If you look at if you look at the data, it's not about what you're holding. It's about where your attention is. So if you're having a conversation with somebody in the are you thinking about tacos?
No, I'm thinking about something else that is more successful if it's about what you're thinking about rather than what you're holding.
So driving is serious, obviously, but all the time. I mean, last week we covered a story about the self-driving car and some statistics on that, and they were talking about all the things that they see while they're, you know, behind the wheel of the self-driving car, and they're looking around and seeing tons of people texting while they're driving, and it's just really bad. Mm-hmm. But what about watches? So the Apple Watch recently came out. There have been Android wearables for a long time. I have a Pebble Watch. I have a Fitbit. So
do you find yourself watching those while you're driving?
I don't look at my Fitbit because there's no real reason to. I guess, yeah. I could look at my heart rate if I really wanted to. But, I mean, that's not really compelling. But if your phone buzzes and you get a text and you're already inclined to look at that, if your wrist buzzes, you're definitely going to look at it. Mm. And that's really, really scary when you're driving a 2-ton vehicle down the road at 80 miles an hour. That's a really bad idea. So,
agreed.
Yes. So this is kind of, this question has just been just barely kind of being raised and looking at in terms of legislation. And of course, legislation is going to be very far behind the times, of course, as technology goes faster and
faster. Doesn't it seem like a way of wording it in a way that can account for distracting new technology of the future without being so broad that it makes it illegal to wear a watch? Or something.
Well, yeah. So actually, some different states have different laws. And I'm just going to, there's a great article, which is going to be up at geekspeak.org. Actually, it's up at geekspeak.org. And it kind of lists out a few more that I'm going to mention. But first of all, none of the U.S. states, because we're in the states, just I'm thinking about the U.S. states, and none of them have updated their distracted driving laws to address the Apple Watch or any other wearables. And No states currently have plans to do so, at least as of April, which is really bad news, right? So,
well, it's great news for the Apple Watch wearers for the short term.
For the short term, right. I mean, I wonder if we'll be able to see that statistically in terms of who gets into accidents. You know, maybe people with wearables are more likely to.
Maybe.
Of course, there's not really a lot of data on this right now, but I'm sure there soon will be. Also, in certain states, like for example in Oregon, the state law specifically bans drivers from holding or operating mobile communication devices. And that's defined as, quote, a text messaging device or a wireless two-way communication device. So little, you know, radio things that you would, you know, talk to the car next to you or something on a road trip. But thank you. That's,
CB radios?
I'm like, there's an easier way to say
CBs.
This.
It was CBs for the cars.
They're outlining those in Oregon?
Yeah, in Oregon, the law bans drivers from holding or operating devices that fall into
that. What are the truckers supposed to do? Breaker 1-9. What about that?
I don't know.
Rabbit ears.
Right. But when it comes to laws that are saying you're not allowed to hold blah, 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 blah,
mm-hmm.
if something's on your on your wrist, is that you holding it?
No.
It's kind of attached to your body.
No, it's not. You hold
right,
it.
Exactly.
That's your
same
wearing.
Same with Bluetooth headsets.
Sure.
Right?
Right.
So you could define it pretty broadly and say that Bluetooth headsets are a text messaging device or a wireless two-way communication device. Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this just raises the point that legislature is always going to be behind technology. And so ultimately, although this may be addressed properly, which maybe it will, maybe it won't, it's ultimately up to us as users of the technology to use it responsibly, whether or not it's legal.
Yeah.
It's not the legality.
The etiquette of when to use various devices.
I also think it's... As more and more people use the different technology, laws that are appropriate to the use will become probably more practical. Like they will match better the technology at hand.
Figure out the wording.
Yeah, normally, laws are kind of
slow.
Sloppy and slow at first.
But then again, I mean, personally, I see people on their phones holding their phones to their ear all the time, despite there being a law against it.
Yeah.
It still happens. So even if we do get laws that are catering specifically to the technologies that are in the ecosystem, I don't know. It's just difficult.
You know, I want to reiterate that if you're using your phone in your hand, you're holding it, you're talking on the phone, that statistically is as dangerous as being drunk while driving.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wouldn't drive and drink, what do you call it?
Podcast and drink.
Yeah. I'm drinking today. Coffee only, please. then don't phone and don't text and don't call people.
Yeah, absolutely. And then
it's a matter of just making it really uncool and kind of frowned on.
I guess
I just said it was bad, so now it's uncool. Come on, people.
Yeah.
It's difficult to change people's behavior when there's something that's that convenient, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the potential consequences are very, very large and very infrequent. And humans don't learn very well from those kinds of
events. That's true, yeah.
The last thing I want to say on this is just keep in mind that even if you do a little cost-benefit analysis in your head and you think, you know what, I might get into an accident, that's a risk I'm willing to take, that's not a risk that I, as your fellow driver, am willing to take. Nor do I have any choice in it.
It's not just up to you, device haver. It's also impacting the people you're driving
around. So if you have a device and you're thinking about doing that, keep in mind it's not just you who you're affecting.
Absolutely.
Of course, none of it would be an issue if we had our dang self-driving cars, Lyle.
That's true.
That would be great.
Nice segue, Bonnie. So Google has been working on self-driving cars for a while, actually. And the cars that we've seen out on public streets are actually cars that are licensed to be cars already. So the self-driving cars we've seen are cars that have already gone through the process and gotten certified as a vehicle and then modified to be a self-driving car. Google has had a lot of experience with their Lexus SUVs driving down the freeways and such.
Mm-hmm. I see one almost every day.
Yeah.
Well, I saw one today.
Yeah. I mean, definitely we're in the area.
I work right down the street.
You guys are on the spotting side of the hill.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So Google's Mountain View campus has a lead engineer or lead scientist responsible for the car. And that is Chris Urmson. And there's this great story of that he's just recently told. He takes somebody for the first time. They get in the Lexus, which is a self-driving car that Google has modified. It starts driving. They get down the freeway, and partly down the freeway, the passenger looks at him and says, that's it? Like, there's nothing to this. It just does it what you'd expect, and there's not.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, no, it's really hard. We work hard to do this.
That's
right? So
it
now it's like, and that's exactly what you want it to be, right?
Right.
You want the self-driving car to not be something you're even thinking about as a danger or surprising or anything like that. It's not like it's flying, right? It's not changing things very much, except for it's probably going to be a little safer, and there's not a person having to focus.
What they should do is just like take up a game of cards.
Definitely. You
could pull out the carafe.
Absolutely.
Really go for it.
So
what are all the things that you can't, like check the wear? What is the Apple Watch?
Google really is targeting, of course, is a very different kind of vehicle. The vehicles we think of are cars that we drive. They have steering wheels. They have all these things that are important to driving.
Yeah.
And the car that they've been working on, the little jelly bean car, what do you call it? You had a great
the cutest little self-driving car you ever did see.
And
that
little
one?
Tiny puffball of car. They've made 25 of these cars. These are not technically street legal. When they tried to process them as street legal, California said, you need to have a steering wheel, and you need to have an accelerator, and you need to have a brake.
So this is a little disappointing because I thought when you were like, hey, you could get a ride in a self-driving car, that we're all going to get in that little jelly bean cutso.
Well, so they will be coming out this summer. They're going to have 25 out in the streets of California this summer. They have added a steering wheel and a brake and accelerator,
so
which is a little unfortunate
around.
Because
yeah, that's too bad, then you kind of
we don't really want that.
The...
But that's more of a legislative reason than anything else. So we will be seeing them, and you get to potentially a chance to drive them and be in them, or I should say ride in them.
Mm-hmm.
They're launching a program where you can go and try it out. Now, they will be doing this no matter what California says, because they've got a whole bunch of private access land up on Moffett Field where you can actually drive around in them. And they, I think, want to get people involved and engaged with it to try it out. So they're announcing this program that you can go up and try it out if you're in this area. And I suggest that we go up and try on the vehicle and
that'd
see
be cool.
what it's like.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Can we, as a sort of like a field exercise?
As a field exercise.
I mean, kind of their biggest problem is the human factor, right?
Those darn pesky humans.
It's almost like humans will never trust something that, you know, like we like to think that we're better at controlling things than say machines or whatever.
So sloppy.
Horrible, horrible. So, it seems like a really good next step for them to get humans a little more comfortable with it.
Yeah. And if you think you're really smart like that, just tell me if it's a black and blue dress or gold and white dress, right?
Geez.
I mean, their brains see different things all the time. So hopefully the computers will be better at it. I don't know if they will be, but I'm looking forward to trying it out. The question I've got is, you know, are we going to be in a situation where we're concerned about, I don't know, the operating system rebooting? Like, that's the kind of thing that concerns me. And in software development, as Ben, you and I know, the more complicated a software system is, the more bugs there are in it. Not whether there are bugs in it. There are bugs in it, you know, once you get a certain level. And there are mathematical proofs to solve for bugs. You can actually prove mathematically the system doesn't have bugs, but you need very specific languages to do that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Google's doing that. They might just be building off of Android. Who knows?
There's also, fail-safe mechanisms. So if the system goes down for some reason because of some bug, how good are the fail-safe mechanisms?
Right.
Like, if you look at anti-lock brakes, that is a computer that's doing that. It's not mechanical.
Yeah.
So,
all right. So anyway, we're looking forward to seeing trying out the driving car.
Yeah, and hopefully with non-fatal bugs. That'd be great.
That would be wonderful.
Even better.
I'd like to know.
All right. With the self-driving car. What about my flying car? Where's that?
Oh boy. Okay. So I first learned about the flying cars when I was a kid with the Jetsons, and I was really excited about them. Before I cover the story, I just want to make a brief note that as I've gotten older and as flying cars have turned from the thing of the Jetsons, who knows how it works, right? It just kind of floats and it works and nothing bad happens and there are no people whose heads it can fall on. And then you kind of bring that to reality and it just doesn't quite work, you know, like
crashing and things.
Like we're talking about, you know, what if the operating system fails on a self-driving car? What if it fails on a flying car? I mean, that's really bad.
You can't just pull over and stop is the problem.
No, exactly. Mm-hmm. And pretty much anywhere it could crash could be on someone's head or someone's house or someone's car. So anyway, this is an interesting story about a flying car company called Aero Mobile, and they released a statement confirming that, quote, the inventor and test pilot, Stefan Klein, encountered an unexpected situation and activated the advanced ballistic parachute system at an altitude of approximately 300 meters. In other words, he ejected. He emergency ejected.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was this incident. And I'll just continue reading what the company says about it. The company additionally said, quote, the system has proved itself fully functional and landed the entire vehicle without injury to the pilot. It also didn't say anything about crashing or anything. It also said...
that sounds like not the whole story to me.
It also said, quote, detailed data and overall experience from this test flight will be thoroughly analyzed and the results will be used in the ongoing R&D improvements to the prototype.
Now, I wouldn't be surprised if that ballistic parachute system actually captured the entire vehicle. But you're saying that
it was just the cockpit pilot because,
that's too bad.
According to eyewitnesses...
Oh, here we go. Point, counterpoint.
This is a quote from the article. According to eyewitnesses, the plane appeared to have experienced problems and gone into a tailspin before it crashed into the ground. Its pilot used the parachute system built into the car and made his way out safely. So, no loss of life or anything. More than anything to me, this is to me saying don't try and put crazy PR spins on, you know, failed rocket launches or test flights or anything like that, you know. So SpaceX has been a really good example of, you know, something goes wrong, they say, yeah, something went wrong. Here's a video of it. Here's another video of it. Here's a close-up video of it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know about, you know, this kind of PR inspiring a lot of confidence. Clearly, they're not interested in saying, yeah, our flying car crashed, but we're going to learn from the experience. They're more interested in saying, there was an incident, but it was fine. And the vehicle landed.
Nobody panic.
In a way.
Nobody panic. So the question is, what helps people panic less? Saying nobody panic or being clear about what's going on?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Elon Musk's recent quote about flying cars was that they, quote, could potentially fall on your head and will be susceptible to the weather. So...
I don't know why that's so funny.
I don't know.
They're all right, but, you know, they could potentially fall on your head.
Also, if you're imagining the Jetsons car, this looks like a small plane with wheels that, you know, the wheels or the plane wings fall
up. I tell you what,
and...
I'll be happy when it looks like a Jetsons car and it makes the Jetsons car sound. Yeah, yeah. Some
little higher,
bugs
though.
Have that sound. They could just kind of transpose it. Yeah.
Oh, hey. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, all right. So, at not yet time for the flying car.
Yeah.
What about just commandeering your own plane? Is that something that can happen?
Well, not exactly commandeering, but Chris Roberts in April 15th was flying on a plane, and he is a programmer, hacker, and that kind of thing. And he wrote on Twitter, "Find myself." I'm quoting Chris Roberts now. That's I won't give you the quick Twitter name. "Find myself on the 737/800. Let's see. Box IFE ICE SATCOM. Shall we start playing with EICAS messages? Pass oxygen on. Anyone?" Now,
what
he's talking about,
it
doesn't mean a lot to us, but what it actually means is that he had taken a Cat5 cable, a network cable, and plugged into the system on the plane from a passenger seat, and then was able to actually access the communication bus of the plane. And by doing that, he could have sent a message, basically an alarm light saying that the oxygen masks were on, so that the captain would think that the oxygen mask had been dropped. Mm. Basically, during a live flight, he actually accessed, well, he said he could access a system and actually engage with the plane. Now, FBI is investigating this, and that's why we haven't heard a lot about it. And now the FBI is kind of saying that, yes, he could have done this. And in fact, the problem with the story is it's still unfolding. And one thing that's amazing and surprising to me is that there's Cat5 ports. This is a network port in the plane regarding the media system, and they're actually in the area of the passengers. So he popped off a plastic plate.
Piece of hardware to access to be able to.
You'd think you wouldn't give that to people you don't
trust.
Commandeer
the controls of the plane. Yeah.
So, well, this shouldn't be actually a system involved with flight control, but it was. He actually popped off a cover and plugged in. So he did have to physically pop something open like you would the back of an alarm clock or something,
okay,
right?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, you'd think there'd be some screws preventing that.
Yeah,
or
and
that's
then
kinda
he
weird.
Got into the system because the usernames and passwords were the default settings, so no one had ever changed them. And then he was able to issue commands. Now, he claims that the continuation of this process, that he was actually able to modify the thruster systems, was only in a test situation, not on the live flight. But that's still under investigation. But the point is that the plane security was breached pretty badly by a passenger. And it's amazing to me, of course, because we do all this work to make planes safe, and yet anybody in that environment could theoretically hack in and modify flight control. The stuff he did on the test flight, or potentially the real flight, if you believe the FBI's current report, was he actually was able to modify the amount of thrust to one of the engines in flight.
Okay, I get it. So, hey, kids, you could have a career in flight.
Career in flight? What do you mean?
Yeah, well, you could find another way to become a pilot without actually having to go to pilot school.
Have vision props? No problem. Learn to hack.
No problemo.
You can fly too.
All right. Well, let's all just contemplate that for a moment while we gather ourselves together. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the effect of Facebook Instant on the World Wide Web. This is Geek Speak on KUSP. Another fine show on KUSP is the Seventh Avenue Project. And next time, in the late 1990s, astronomers got a huge shock when they discovered a mysterious force that's pushing the universe apart at ever faster rates. 15 years later, scientists are still scratching their heads over dark energy and what it means for the future of the cosmos. Astronomer Robert Kirshner, whose team at Harvard University played a key part in the discovery, joins host Robert Pauly to discuss what we know and don't know about dark energy on the next Seventh Avenue Project. That's Thinking Persons Radio tomorrow at noon on KUSP, or at your convenience at the talk section of KUSP's website, kusp.org. Right now you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me is Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffe. Facebook Instant sounds convenient. Is there a problem, Lyle?
Yeah, Bonnie. So I remember years ago when AOL was kind of the king of content. Mm-hmm. And everyone was kind of in their walled garden. Ben, can you describe what an online walled garden
is? Sure. The idea is rather than having... So the internet is everybody's kind of talking to everybody, right? There can be content all over the place. If you have a walled garden, like, for example, let's look at AOL back in the old days. Rather than having everybody creating content, putting it all over the place, everyone connecting to everybody, you had this little AOL bubble that wherein there was a lot of content, and from the outside you couldn't really reach in.
It's like a clump of activity that was just for people who had the CD that came to them in the mail.
Right. Exactly.
So that's what a walled garden is.
Yes. And Facebook is one of those kind of walled gardens, right? If people log into Facebook, you have to have an account to be on there. Mm-hmm. You can actually see some public content without an account. But to really participate, you've got to have an account. And that's why it's been so massively successful. People started adding themselves and so on. Mm-hmm. When, like, a traditional advertiser, or a traditional newspaper content creator, wants to participate in Facebook, what they do is they make a like page, a page on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And then they submit their stories that are actually written, and the whole article is actually on their website.
And there's like a little teaser that gets you over to their website. Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's one of the great features that Facebook has is the ability for anybody to put any content on, and then kind of it shows up in your feed is what it's called. Mm-hmm. And then when you click on it, you go read the article. Mm-hmm. And when you're using a Facebook application, it actually stays in the application. It just opens a web browser and you kind of stay in there, and you can close it and you're still kind of in Facebook.
Yeah. And oftentimes if it's working right at the place where you left off on your wall, if you're like reading down the waterfall.
Yeah. But you're actually going out into the Chrome browser or the WebKit browser or the iOS browser or Safari or whatever.
Right.
So you're not really in the Facebook app for the entire experience. You're going out somewhere else.
And you can kind of tell what the difference is, right? Because what occurs when you click on a news story from another source is it opens up, and it takes a second. It opens a white page, and it takes a second for you to load it.
You know what happens for me?
What?
My phone freezes.
Because I have an Android, old phone, right?
Yeah. I have an Android S3, Galaxy S3, and it's a little slow there.
So Facebook this week announced that, last week announced, that they have this new service called Facebook Instant. And the reason why they use the term instant is the experience they want to have is those external type of stuff, news stories and things, wouldn't take a long time. They would be instantaneous, yes?
And maybe wouldn't freeze up Ben's phone?
Who knows?
So I'm fine
I
with
won't
it
make
so,
that claim.
I'm fine with it so far, but given that it's Facebook, so, I'm wondering what the catch
Facebook
is, right?
Facebook went to some pretty large companies to make deals with them. The companies they went to, New York Times, National Geographic, NBC News, The Atlantic, The Guardian, BBC News, Spiegel Online and Bild, and also BuzzFeed.
Spiegel Online or Smeagol Online?
Spiegel Online?
Is that Gollum's website?
Anyway,
sorry.
I don't know what it is. It's probably
Smeagol Online.
Probably
it's a comedy site.
Okay.
Oh, okay. But big players.
I'm joking.
Big
I don't
players.
Know.
Big players.
You're funny,
you know,
buddy.
Half the world's going to get upset at us for not knowing, right?
Yeah right.
In any case.
But the point is, these are the folks that said, okay, yeah, this sounds like a good deal to me.
They became partners of this instant service. And what that means is that Facebook actually built a content management system, a CMS, that allows these publishers to create articles in Facebook's system. So instead of a user finding a news, you know, New York Times article, clicking on it and linking to the website of New York Times, mm-hmm. instead a fully written article on Facebook is being hosted by Facebook with a tool that Facebook wrote for these newspapers.
Hmm.
With the idea that the user will never really leave Facebook.
You stay in the walled garden, there's not even a little shortcut out and back in again.
That's
You're
right.
just in the garden the whole
so
time.
So I wanted to chat a bit about why this is a problem and what it means in a longevity perspective.
Yeah, because from a user perspective, it seems like a win. It seems like, all right, I've got my content faster. Facebook has the ability to do all kinds of cool things like preloading the content so that way it's just ready for me when I click on it.
And if all you want to do is be in Facebook, then is there a problem?
Right. So as a non-technical user, I'm like, all right, I'm in. That sounds good.
And for these first movers that actually joined the foray, these nine companies that are doing this, it means that the readers that are on Facebook will see them faster and better, more curated. Like, the content will fit the feeling. It's better for them.
This is interesting that it's a good deal for them, even though there isn't a way for people to wind up at their site and get lost there and spend more time there, which is traditionally, I believe, gentlemen, what you're aiming for. Right?
Yes, you are. But the reason you're doing that is you want to get paid, right?
Right.
If you get people to your website, your ads run, and therefore you make money. But part of this deal is to embed advertising that Facebook hosts, and the proceeds go to the provider.
So they share in the ad revenue, so there's no need to get people to their website.
Well, it looks like sharing is an over-exaggeration. Yeah. Facebook's actually giving all these first partners all the revenue of that advertising. Yeah, it looks like 100%.
First one's free, kids.
Yeah. So why would the BBC or whoever else not do this?
Well, that's the thing, is why wouldn't they do it? And the reason they wouldn't do it is if you have one gatekeeper, they have a lot of power. Facebook already has a lot of power.
Yeah, that's true.
There was a similar problem when Google started becoming basically the only way people found stuff on the internet. Mm-hmm. And what would occur was that Google produced this thing called Newsreader, which was, or Newsfeed. Basically, they embedded news stories in Google. And newspaper companies got really upset because you could potentially read most of the story without leaving Google, and therefore they wouldn't get the ad revenue and all that. So a few companies got upset, said, don't do that anymore. Google turned them off. They got no more internet traffic.
There's also a credit problem there. Like, this Google did not write this article.
Well, Google was linking to the article in a way that kind of is like, if you want to read this, go there, right? Mm-hmm. So in some ways, it was beneficial.
So they're not like implying ownership when
No, Google wasn't doing that.
Okay.
But
they're just making it more accessible.
Well, that was Google's argument.
Exactly.
Newspaper argument was, no, you're taking our content and reusing it for your own device. Yeah, and of course, on that news feed, Google's making a lot of money on the advertising of just the feed itself.
Mm-hmm.
But when the companies that got upset about it said stop doing that, Google stopped and their traffic dropped. They basically killed them, right? Without Google pointing to them, they lost all access.
Oh.
The same kind of thing would happen to a company in this new era where like a billion people go onto Facebook every day. A billion.
That's so many people.
That's a lot of peoples.
That's a goodly portion of the planet.
It is. It's like a seventh of the planet.
Just like that.
Yeah. In any case, those people will like the content they see in the instant feed. And inside the feed, it'll be easier to access. It'll be pretty. It won't take very long to load. That's the big thing, right?
So what about me as a non-Facebook user? What happens to me there?
Well, as a non-Facebook user, you'd assume that the New York Times and all those other companies that are participating in this, anybody that does participate after, they'll simply have the same content on their website as well.
Okay.
And you're going to find the content through Google or through other source. But the point for me here is that all of a sudden, Facebook becomes the distributor of the news. And it's very different than what they've been doing. You know, they've been doing lately is allowing people to share information, and then you go and find the stuff other places. But now it's much more like, this is my playground, and you're here.
Here's my information.
So then, yeah.
It's almost like, and this is overstating it, but it's a simplification, right? But if you take it as such, it's almost like Facebook turns from your social network to the internet for you.
Yeah, it
in
does.
A sense, right?
It really
so
does.
You don't really have much of a reason to go anywhere else, meaning that the stuff that you're going to see are specifically the companies who are doing this with Facebook, one. And two, it provides a huge incentive for people who are not on Facebook to be on Facebook because they're missing out on not just a social experience, which Facebook is, you know, trying to to sell you on, but the internet experience, if you will.
Well, and there's another problem. It's the further segregation of content, right?
Yeah.
Segregation in what way?
Well, it's already happening. Like, okay, well, I believe a certain range of ideas, and so I'm only going to read articles by pundits who espouse those ideas.
Yeah, the bubble.
That's already happening, right?
Yeah.
In music, I like this kind of music, so I'm just going to listen to radio stations that inspire me from that.
Yeah, you're talking
kind of
about
music.
The social filter, the filter bubble.
Right, and so here's another one coming with Facebook.
Yeah.
Where if I get all my news from the sources that Facebook chooses for me, then I have less access to information from other sources.
So what you're saying is that the Facebook experience is a curated experience by this idea of whatever clicks and keeps you going, and therefore it might be filtered because of the bubble effect.
Mm-hmm.
And now more of your news will be available only through there, and therefore you won't go to other sources, and pretty soon you'll have a more limited experience.
Right.
Facebook's last study on this, they studied the filter bubble effect, and they showed that actually even the user's choice is a greater choice on not opening something than their filters in place. They did a test. Facebook does tests on people all the time. And what they did is they put a whole bunch, I'm paraphrasing because I didn't prep this story, but they put a whole bunch of stories in front of people. Some were, you know, curated stories, and then some were, well, let me add one in here that's outside their filter bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, the effect in general of their filter bubble versus what the user would and would not read, the user still has a larger effect. So even if they show you stuff that's outside your filter bubble, it's less likely for you to read that, more so than it is for
if
that.
You already have your existing filter going.
Yeah.
Internal filter.
Internal filter, you won't necessarily open it. And that's a bigger show of difference than the filter bubble system in place, where we think you're going to like this because your friends like this, is the algorithms that they currently
use. So if I choose not to read some of their curated content, fine, but I'm still not getting exposed to things that are not in the stream.
No, they're definitely not getting exposed to things that aren't on the stream. And Facebook's done tests where they've been able to, and they've talked about this publicly, been able to affect voter turnout by just telling some people in some district to vote and some people not to vote. Mm-hmm. They have a very powerful sway on the users. And there's nothing legally about them not doing whatever they want with that, right? We've already signed over our own ability to say no to that, right? Mm-hmm. We agree to it all the way. So when they are then the arbiter of most of the news you see, it becomes a question of, are they journalists as well? You know, is Facebook have a journalistic flow?
They become sort of editorial, don't they?
They kind of do, in the sense that they're now showing us what news stories from The Times or from the BBC should show up in the feed. Additionally, though, they're the arbiters because those companies are pushing their content in the Facebook system, they have to agree to certain things with Facebook, right? And so what if one of these stories
has an editorial effect on what a magazine chooses to write or run.
Right. What if they want to cover a really nasty story about Facebook and they're publishing in the Facebook system? There's definitely a potential for conflict of interest. Not that that would occur, but it's something we have to be aware of as mm-hmm. we have a large arbiter. Mm-hmm. And this goes down to the final problem for me is these ideas of these centralized companies controlling so much of who we are and how we communicate is this thing that I don't know how we're going to get out of. Mm-hmm. You know, we have Google telling us how to find things, mm-hmm. and we have Facebook, how we make communications and connections between people. And I'm not saying that everybody's like this and it's 100%. I definitely talk to people on the phone or talk to them at a party. But when 80% of the content you communicate with around people is filtered through these other companies, their power becomes extremely, you know, absolute in some ways. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to make a system to be like an open source system to do the same type of thing. I would love to see that exist. But for years, it's one of the things that always emerges in my mind. How can I make this system open source and more of a standard-based sharing? A social system would be standards. A lot of people have tried and failed.
I mean, I wonder if that's the sort of thing that, like, the Institute for the Future or the Electronic Frontier Foundation is mulling over.
It's definitely
from their insides.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I can imagine.
Where they want
that
it to be a free internet. How do you make sure that it's also a diverse internet?
Yeah. So this is one step down to the lack of diversity on in internet platforms. Facebook's going to own a lot of content now. That being said, from what they're providing, it's really cool. I mean, they're allowing embedded video. They're allowing embedded maps.
Pretty.
It's almost like app quality stuff inside the system. And therefore, people are going to really like this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's going to be a compelling walled garden.
Yes.
Just stay in here where it's nice.
Cozy and pretty.
Golly. Well, as we contemplate our dystopian future, we'll be right back. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. It's Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and I'm here with Ben Jaffe and Lyle Troxell. Incidentally, if you'd like to communicate with the show, one way you can reach us is via Twitter. We're at KUSP Geeks. That's all one word. And if you have questions or comments for us, you could send a tweet or an email. We're geeks@geekspeak.org. You can also reach us on Facebook. We're there. We admit it. We're KUSP Geeks there, too. Anyway, we'll collect up whatever feedback you've got. And perhaps it'll wind up on the air. Speaking of things that get you places where you weren't expecting, Starbucks gift cards apparently have some sort of a security hole.
Oh, well, kind of. Not exactly a security hole. But it's more the entire big picture. So,
okay.
For example.
What do you see? What do you see?
You can get a Starbucks account. And you can go online and you can put money on your Starbucks card and your Starbucks account. It's actually very convenient. They've given you all these perks. You can get this and that little flavor shots for free.
So you can have a gift card and just keep adding money onto it.
Yeah, you have your Starbucks
cash in the store.
So imagine your Starbucks card is like a credit card, but for a debit card, but for Starbucks coffee, right? So seems okay, but
I've used them.
You've used them, okay?
Sure.
I actually don't have one, but so.
Well, they're kind of like these temporary cards you get, and then they go. I mean, you fill them up.
Do you ever go and fill them up again?
I've never filled them up.
Nope, that's done.
But I have used the app on my phone.
Well, how do you regularly get Starbucks coffee?
Well, my former job, about a year and a half ago, I was getting at Starbucks a lot because I was with somebody that liked Starbucks. Okay. I personally don't like Starbucks very much.
Oh, okay.
I'm kind of a coffee snob. But then again, I'm social, so whatever people want to do, I do.
Yeah, me too. So here's the problem with Starbucks accounts. It's that you can do things. For example, you can, if I were to compromise your account, Lyle,
okay,
and you had some money in your account, I could then transfer your money to a Starbucks gift card, which I was in possession of.
Wait, so are you talking about my Starbucks account or just any account?
Your Starbucks account.
My Starbucks account, okay.
Yeah. I could transfer, let's say you had $100. I could transfer that $100 onto a gift card, which then I could sell to someone online for $35 or something like that. And it turns out things like that actually happen quite often. Now, you do need to have your account compromised in order for this to happen.
How does one compromise a Starbucks account?
And how does one tell when it is compromised?
How does one compromise any account?
Get the password? No, wait, get the number?
Yeah, get the username and the password and then log in. So
So don't write your password on your Starbucks gift card.
So yeah, this is a good jumping off point to talk about passwords. Yeah, I guess we'll just jump into that. So I guess the perspective I want to paint is more that rather than just this being an account for your coffee, like, I don't need a strong password for this. It's just my Starbucks account.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
What'll happen is if your account gets compromised and actually a whole bunch of login credentials appeared and no one is really sure from where on this site Evolution, which recently went offline, but it was a website for illegal goods. So there are a bunch of usernames and passwords out there. Incidentally, if you have a Starbucks account, you may want to change it just in case, you know. But what they would do is they would transfer money out, and then they have some money out of your Starbucks account. Presumably, Starbucks would pay for that much in the same way your bank would pay for a fraudulent account or some activity on your credit card. But if you have auto reload, things get trickier.
Oh, no.
Right.
So auto reload, of course, you set up an account. So when your Starbucks card gets too low, it automatically debits a bit more from your ATM account, right?
Yeah. Now, the same thing
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Same thing happens with like the Clipper card, any transit cards, right? When you travel a whole bunch, then, you know, you only have $10 on your Clipper card. So it charges you for $50 more and then you don't get stranded somewhere.
But normally those things work such that it's one account and you're going to use it by traveling, right? Or you're going to use it by buying coffee.
You have to directly use it.
Because the Starbucks account, you can buy a gift certificate that can then be used anywhere. It's a way to pull money out of your ATM into the Starbucks account, then from the Starbucks account into cash type cards that you can then use anywhere.
So yeah, exactly. So everybody knows, whether or not we do, everybody knows you should have a strong password for your bank. Everybody knows that. If you don't know that, now you know that. But if you imagine your bank and then you've got this little tunnel into your Starbucks account, if you think of it that way, you empty your Starbucks account, a little more money trickles out of your bank account into your Starbucks account, right?
Now you better have a good password on your silly Starbucks account.
Exactly. Now, if you take that...
I feel queasy, you guys.
You should.
I'm very disturbed.
I want to generalize this even a little bit more, and I want to talk about not just money transferring out of your bank account to your Starbucks card,
okay,
but something like your Facebook account and your Gmail account, right? What I'm saying is there are connections between all of your accounts, even the minor ones, right?
So, for example,
yes.
What happens if you lose your password off your Starbucks account? How do you recover it?
I just click I forgot my password. And
then
it
email you a password reset to your Gmail account or whatever email account you have.
Yeah. Which
so, therefore, if your password's easy on your email, people can get money out of your checking account.
Yes. If your password's wrong on your recovery email for your Starbucks account, bad news. So I guess the perspective I'm trying to point out.
If I think about the general Geek Speak Council on passwords, it's to have it be a crazy long phrase with some numerals thrown in there. And you have to come up with one of those for your Starbucks card now, too.
Everywhere.
Yes, because who does that? Not
very
many people do.
Is there one pass for your goofy Starbucks card?
Yeah, use 1Password or LastPass.
How does that even work?
Password management systems allow you to have an encrypted ball of passwords, and you make a new, unique one for every place you use. Then you have to have access to the encrypted ball, which for like 1Pass or LastPass or 1Password, you can have on your phone and on your desktop computer and sync them. And all of that's kind of technical and hard, but you probably need to learn it.
Sorry. I'll admit, okay, Hey, listeners. I've been listening for years to the geeks say, oh, I should get LastPass or 1Password or whatever.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I got it. I got the new iPhone, so I went, okay, I'll get it. And then it said, okay, here, let's go account by account. I'm like, oh, I give up. I instantly gave up.
Well, it's easy. It's easy to give up because you might have 100 accounts.
Exactly.
You probably
but,
do.
But,
all with 12345 is your password.
Yeah, exactly.
So the combination is 12345. That's the stupidest combination I ever heard in my life. That's the kind of thing an idiot would have on his luggage.
Well, did it work? Where's the key?
It worked, sir. We have the combination.
Great. What's the combination?
12345.
12345?
Yes.
That's amazing. I've got the same combination on my luggage.
If you start thinking about your accounts as being connected to each other, if you start thinking about the accounts that, I don't really care if someone compromises this account, it doesn't have anything important, just double check that thinking because it might.
Right. It if it links to something might. Important, it is important.
Yeah. Your Starbucks account actually might be kind of important when it's linked to your bank account.
Yikes. Okay. I'm sufficiently spooked.
Okay. Now, this other story is a quick one, but it's about using statistics to crack passwords. So if you're thinking from the perspective of someone who is trying to protect their account, congratulations, you're just thinking like normal. But if you turn it around and you think from the perspective of someone who's trying to crack into someone else's account, that's when things get interesting. And you start to be able to make these different assumptions, high probability assumptions, right? If you're trying to crack passwords, you're probably looking for the lowest or low-ish hanging fruit. So
monkey's a very
lowest popular. Hanging monkey?
Well, monkey is a very, very common password. A lot of people use
monkeys
monkey.
Also enjoy low-hanging
like,
fruit.
Monkeys, yeah.
Monkeys do enjoy, like the password monkey.
Monkeys can fly. It can climb. Yeah, so password 123, monkey, those are all very bad passwords. Lyle, you have a pretty darn long password, right?
What is
for
it?
Your...
My password starts with a...
Anyway.
My main encryption password that actually encrypts my...
Yes.
All my passwords is some duration of I have to type it out to figure it out, but it's a random generated thing, right?
You've memorized.
It's a hash of random of over 20 characters that I've memorized.
Okay, yes. I would never try to go for your accounts because
right.
they are well protected.
Right, like my luggage is really well protected. Sorry, right. That's right.
I would instead kind of do a wide scan and try and find the people who are using the worst passwords and use these different methodologies for attacking them. So
you know,
there's
Bonnie noticed how he looked at me and said I wouldn't go after you, Lyle. And then there was quiet in the room. So I think he's going after your passwords. You should run.
Who? Where?
I think Ben is. Ben is saying.
Ben, stay away from my passwords.
I am not malicious. I'm white hat. Anyway, there's a thing called a dictionary attack. This is a pretty easy attack to do. Basically, it just checks a whole bunch of words in the word list. So it checks for aardvark, and then it checks for albacore, and then it
like
checks
the dictionary.
For... Right, exactly. That's why they call it a dictionary attack. Then you've got hybrids. So it's either going to put words together, maybe two of the words in the dictionary. It'll also augment the word list by adding characters before or after. So if you choose monkey zero... Still a horrible password. It won't get caught in a dictionary attack, but it will get caught in the next easiest attack to run.
Which is a modified dictionary.
Which is a hybrid / rules password attack.
The other things they'll do is they'll change L's into 1's, things like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so if you think you're smart
being clever
by saying
with your numerals.
Pass what 0 RD, nope. Mm. Then there's the Markov password attack, and this is, I'm really glossing over, there's a lot of different permutations of all this, but you can use machine learning to assemble possible guesses based on what words likely will go into other words will likely go into other words, right? So the phrase computer, black, sun, those words won't go into each other very well, so that's probably going to be a better password. If you were going to do something like that, you might want to use 4 words or 5 words instead and make them unrelated, as opposed to MacBook Pro. That's a very common...
Not a good thing to use, yeah.
Those words go into each other.
The other thing to note about this is that if you think you're being clever with your password scheme, you're wrong.
Yes, that's true.
Like someone has thought about it.
Random generation...
How many seconds did it take you to think of your password? Okay.
If you're doing something clever with your password... You failed, because the truth is that the algorithms are intentionally designed to find patterns the way we think, and we've looked. You know, systems have looked at millions of people's passwords and found that oh, look what clever ways they think of things. We'll just bake that into the password cracking software, and therefore, yeah.
Now, so every time there's a guideline for how to construct a password,
and that's
it's
actually
also
where I'm going next.
A format for how to break a password, right?
So here's where I'm going next. How many of you two? You can raise your hands because this is radio. how many have you guys gone to a website and they say, "Sorry, that's a bad password. It must contain a special character."
Oh, it's really bad. Yeah,
I'm raising
my
hand now.
Right, definitely, yeah. I'm raising my hand too. So this is an interesting password attack, and this is kind of getting behind criticism not of people who make the passwords, but of people who enforce stupid rules on the passwords. This goes for almost any online service, unfortunately, right? So, and this is called a mask password.
They're
attack.
Trying to get people to be smart about their passwords by saying, add this and add that and add that. But as soon as they make a rule, then the hackers can use the rule, right?
So let's say that... Let's say that
their search, I would think.
Let's say that you had a horrible password like kumquat, okay?
It starts with a K.
But
starts
it's
with
also
K.
So fun to say.
It's really tasty, too.
Okay, let's say...
Monkey.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good one. It's a bad one. So... If you type that into some website, right, and it says, sorry, that password is not secure enough, you need to add a number. What do you think your password's going to be?
Monkey one.
I would have chosen monkey zero, but regardless, you're not going to choose M-O-392-N-K-E-Y, right? It's unlikely. You're probably just going to append a digit at the end.
Yeah.
Maybe at the beginning. And you can actually... You can actually take that into account in your password attacks if you are a malicious hacker. By the way, I'm not giving away anything here. All the malicious hackers already know all this, right? But if the password says you have to contain a number, chances are there's just going to be a number at the end, right? If you need to contain a special character, chances are it's going to be one of, let's say, 10 different special characters, and it's going to be probably at the end, right? It's likely what will happen.
Yeah.
And capitalization, if you have to have a capitalized letter, you're probably going to capitalize the beginning because humans like capitalizing the beginnings of things. So that's
bad. Another common one is if the password has an S in it and then you're asked for a special character, people normally replace the S with a dollar sign because that's a special character and it still looks like an S and therefore that's what
they use. Akesha did that, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, so all of this to say that if you're making a password, you want to try something actually secure. And the most secure thing you can do is to make an actually random password and use a password generator or a password manager like 1Password or LastPass, or there are a couple of others out there to keep track of all of that. And two, if you are managing a website where you're making your users add crazy characters and stuff like that, you're not making them more secure. You might be making them less secure.
The other thing you can do with that is run a dictionary attack. Do a few things and not accept the ones that fail that attack. And the other thing you can do is give people a bar of how secure the password actually is with some algos. Mm-hmm. And the algorithms are – there's some open source algorithms
that do
this.
I've seen that too, where it kind of like you as you type it in, it goes like, well, red,
yes,
yellow, oh, green.
Yeah, and those are actually really good because they're kind of analyzing. Some of them are.
Some of them are. Yeah. And the problem with those is that they're all always a little different and they're probably not actually telling you how secure your password is. They're just running it across.
Ugh, fine. I won't use the internet.
The
Jeez.
Longer the blah, password, blah, blah. Normally the better. And the other thing is passwords we all know are broken and we're going to have to get away from them.
Yeah.
Passwords are probably going to be mostly gone within 10 years. There's other technologies coming about.
Like the touch screen, my thumbprint.
Yeah, the ability to use your phone as a trusted system. Yeah. Mm.
If you're listening to the show.
Which
and,
people are.
And you're not worried about the first four that I gave you, you've succeeded. Your password is sufficiently strong because the last password attack is brute force. That literally tries every possible combination of characters until it gets through. And if your password is as long as Lyle's, it'll take a couple trillion years. So
we're good there.
We'll just hope that you're in that camp.
Golly.
It's hard.
I mean, I guess I was just supposed to do the work, right? Even LastPass seems like, oh, God, what a bother.
The problem is, even if you come up with a really long password like mine, if I were to use that more than just one location and anybody got cracked, then bam, we've got a problem.
Right.
So I only use that password in one location, right? Only to encode all my other passwords. But it does make life very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason it works is because I'm technical enough to understand.
I miss the days when
it.
I could just use the same password for everything.
The other thing you can do is write down on a spreadsheet on a computer or write down on paper like 50 passwords, right, mm-hmm. on a piece of paper in a book or something that you carry with you. And then whenever you use one, just say what site you used it on and just keep that thing. And then Xerox it and put a copy in your desk. That's so much more secure than
paper.
Doing what you've been doing. Yeah, yeah, paper on your, because who's going to get into your dresser in your house, right? Mm-hmm. And then you keep it in your wallet and hope that when your wallet gets stolen, people don't get into your passwords.
There you go.
Don't keep it in your wallet. All right, just a short period of time left. Do you think we have time to talk about something that I didn't think was going to be big news again? America Online?
America Online, yes. So America Online came into existence in around, Ben, you got a guess from this? Because I found this a lot earlier than I thought it was.
When AOL started?
1989.
What?
So in 1989, AOL came out and it became this massive spamming company that turned out tons of CDs. And everybody signed up for it. It mm-hmm. became a very successful hit. And it's been around for a long time. It merged with Time Warner at some point. It's bought Netscape at one point for millions of dollars. And just recently, for $4.4 billion, it was purchased by Verizon.
Why? Are AOL addresses somehow sort of retro hip again? I don't understand.
Verizon just wanted good dial-up. I don't know.
Yeah.
Verizon's probably buying it because of its ad network and its user base. Mm. And it does make sense to some degree. AOL has a lot of content providers, a lot of news sites and such.
Well, I guess we'll catch that story later as it develops. Meanwhile, this has been GeekSpeak. And GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use every stuff any we like, etc., etc. This is public radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. Find out more about us at geekspeak.org. Our theme music is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. And we'll catch you next time on GeekSpeak.